Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. My shop, which recently won Best Bookshop in Philadelphia and Best Non-Corporate Coffee Shop. I don't know what that means, but we did win it. And then blah, 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 blah is written here, which I have now realized means I'm supposed to tell you, not give you a list of all the social media we're on because it takes forever, but just Google us. Google has been nice to us because we have a YouTube channel and they own YouTube. So we come right to the top and you can see all the places we're on. Including Facebook, et cetera. So today, we are most pleased to have with us Judith Claire Mitchell, Claire being her very likable mother's name. So, A Reunion of Ghosts, which is Judith's second novel, was published on March 24th of this year by HarperCollins. And it's truly wonderful and very, very funny. And her first novel is The Last Day of the War. It's a reunion. It's a tale of three less than comely women, sisters, who inherit a legacy of horror, suicide, and less than stellar relatives, mates, and careers. And it's very funny and uplifting. And I know you might not believe that based on my just summary just then, but read it and then you'll understand. It's gotten great reviews from lots of publications, including one I really like, Publishers Weekly, but that review mentions the word coruscating. And I think they should have just said sparkling. I mean, really, coruscating. They didn't have to use that. So
I'm going to look it up.
So did I. I also looked up your term for a group of raccoons. But so the book, again, is about three sisters who decide, as all of their immediate family apparently has, commit suicide in tandem. I don't know if in tandem you can do with three people. Mm. But unlike their deceased predecessors, they want to leave a suicide note detailing the reasoning and the background behind their decision. From there on, things get a little dicey. But before I ramble on, as I do, and forget there's someone else on the other end of this line, allow me to introduce and thank Judith Claire Mitchell for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm already having fun.
Me too. But that's because I'm talking. As long as I'm talking, I'm having a great time.
I know that feeling.
So tell us a little bit about, I guess the best way to talk about it is because this is the way the book is tell us a little bit about Lily, Veronica, and Delphine, or Lady V and Delph.
So Lady V and Delph are three baby boomer sisters. They're writing toward the end of the 20th century. Their lives have not quite taken off the way they might have hoped. And they come from a long family of suicides. And they kind of figure it's their time. They have chosen New Year's Eve of 1999 as a good time to go. And as you say, before they do, first, they've always wanted to write their memoir / suicide note. And so that's what they sit down to do. That's the book is their goodbye to the world, their explanation for what they're doing, and their history of their own family, of the past four generations of the Alter family, who are based on actually a historical family. Their great-grandfather is based on the German-Jewish chemist Fritz Haber, who won the Nobel Prize for synthesizing the first man-made fertilizer. So it's not only a book about suicide, it's a book about fertilizer. Pretty hard to resist. But he also then tweaked that formula for fertilizer and created the first chemical weapons used in warfare. So that's kind of their legacy, problematic legacy, that haunts them and they feel they are somewhat cursed by.
You know, if you really want people to read the book, you can also say it's partly about paralegals and
yes.
And dentist assistants.
Estate planning paralegals. Yes, which was a job I held myself for 20 years. People always say to me, oh, such a grim, horrible job. And I'm like, well, it wasn't that bad.
Well, I was a lawyer for 30-some years, and the reason I liked it was because I got to do different things. It wasn't routine like everybody thought it was. And I like the way you talk about a testator gradually giving away everything until he gives away his children, and then he finally has his first intimation of mortality.
Yeah, you know, as I was a paralegal for 20 years, but I was also always had the heart of a writer. So every document I drafted seemed like poetry to me, written in this arcane language, you know, not quite Chaucerian, but still this strange language that they use, and dealing with the most fundamental things we deal with in life, you know, the things we possess and our lives, our very lives in wills. I can remember once reading, I was waiting for a will to run off the printer, and there was a document about in vitro fertilization, and it was the most poignant, profound legal document I'd ever read. So, yes.
Well, it's funny because when I first started practicing, there was this old lawyer who would never retire. His name was Ray Helpling. And I said to him, Ray, I mean, sometimes I try to start a document and I have no idea how to, like, the very first sentence. And he goes, just always start it with, know all men by these presents. And then you just wing it from there and it works out fine. And it did.
Yeah, yeah. There should be trumpets played.
Yeah, it's true. And people like it. They don't know what it means, but they like it. I still don't know what it means.
They do. I mean, all right, we're going to spend this whole podcast talking about legal documents.
Sorry, I'm not selling your book.
I'm into it. People always want to, you know, simplify them and put them into plain English, but I love the old words. I love, you know, people say, why can't you just say, I give my property? And but then you don't have, I give, devise, and bequeath. I love devise and bequeath.
Yeah, it's always three words, actually. You have to use three words.
Always three words.
Yeah. It's funny. That's what, you know, I am Jewish, but I used to love, I love going to St. Pat's and lighting a candle for my ex-mother-in-law, who is Irish Catholic. And they raised the price from $1 to $2, which I'm not paying $2. I will pay $1. I'm not paying $2.
I don't want to say anything about being Jewish, but...
But
I'm Jewish too.
I know. I mean, I assumed when he goes, "Oy, my schnoz," I assumed that was you. but I like the Latin Mass. I don't like an English Mass. I like the censers and the incense and the Latin Mass. That makes it all kind of real in this not real way, which is kind of like your book in a way. Yeah, so I'm interested in covers and epigraphs. And any cover that has the Chrysler building on it, I'm going to buy the book. And
oh, good.
So the thing about it is, owning an independent bookstore, and I've said this before on the show, people always say, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. But every single person who comes into that bookstore judges a book by its cover, and you have a good one.
Right, right.
Did you vet it, or did they decide? How did it work? Did you pick it?
It's interesting how it worked. They designed a beautiful cover, and they showed it to me, and I loved it. And one day I got an email from my editor saying, surprise, we've changed the cover. They decided the original cover was too serious, and while it's I think of it as a very serious book, obviously it also has humor in it. And they wanted to catch some of that energy. I didn't vet the second cover, although I think if I had said, I cannot live with it, they would have respected that. But I loved it immediately.
Yeah, I love it because at the bottom right-hand corner, you see the girls.
Yeah, yeah. And they don't have faces, but so, you know, they're there, but they're not there. Excuse me. I have a little bit of a flu, but...
That's okay. Well, I mean, sorry. I was going to say that's okay. Well, you know, the thing about it is, you know, when books start out with a family tree, I'm always a little trepidatious because I don't know if it's going to be like Gabriel Garcia Marquez and like 20 Aurelios. You know, it's like I don't want 20 Aurelios. But yours is easy. And I thought, okay, this is a serious book. But then I looked down in the lower left-hand corner and it says, It's got Joe, and it's got its birth date, and it says, who cares?
Right.
And then I realized, no, this is going to be a funny book. You have to admit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good start to funny.
They said to me, after the book was written, they said, do you think this is the kind of book that needs a family tree? And as a writer, you just want more and more stuff in your book. And I was like, yes, 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 so let's do a family tree. And I couldn't believe the things they let me get away with. So when I did that for Joe, and I was like, who cares if he's alive or dead?
Seriously, the guy's such a jackass. I mean,
I was surprised they let me keep that, but they did.
No, it was really funny. But, you know, the first time I read it, looked at it, the second time I didn't see it. And then I looked down the lower corner and I said, and I just laughed out loud, which is what you're looking for.
Good.
So how come you didn't make the three daughters, the three sisters, babes? I wanted them to be Comely so I'd fall in love with them that way. But I still fell in love with them. But I thought about that just as I was reading their descriptions, which were really good. But then I thought, ooh, couldn't they be pretty?
Life is so much easier for pretty women. I really stacked the deck against these poor girls.
You did.
They're women. I call them girls because, I don't know, I think of them as my kids, sort of. I really wanted them to have a hard row, and it's an interesting subject to me. Being unattractive or overweight, as society deems that, for women is really an issue. It shouldn't be. It should be totally irrelevant. And I love that you fell in love with them anyway. And then at a certain point in the book, we also find out that they are perhaps harder on themselves than other people are, that they judge their appearances much more harshly than other people do. And I thought that was important too, because I think that's very characteristic of contemporary women.
It's funny, you know, early on in my adolescence, when guys would joke around whether they were breast men or leg men or this or that, it's funny because I never thought of it. It was like, were they funny? You know, did they have a good sense of humor? That was the first thing that I was interested in. And so then that's when my attraction began, because they were so sardonic and cynical and sarcastic, and it was exactly the type of person I would like to be with, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's good. When I was a teenager, I remember having the revelation that if a person who you didn't find attractive right off the bat was in some way a wonderful person, they became more attractive. I can remember seeing someone who I had not found, a guy who I had not found cute to begin with, and not being able to remember how I could possibly have not found him cute once I got to know him. And I thought that was a good thing.
It is. You know, we're all in these receptacles that we get when we start out, and
yes,
it's a shame. But if you can see past that, it does mean I think that you'll have a good life. Hey,
I think so.
We've been talking for 13 minutes and I haven't gotten past the cover of the book, and I'm not going to either. So,
okay, let's talk about the cover of the book.
Well, because you get this blurb from Anthony Doerr, and you know, now you got to change it now since he won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes, I changed it on my website in like 3 seconds.
And he's such a great guy, and he. Mm-hmm. What I do at the bookstore is this, because we've sold more of that book than anything else we've sold.
And I'm so happy to hear it.
And what happens is I just give people the book and I say, here, buy this. If you don't like it, bring it back.
Uh-huh.
And nobody has brought it back. You can't.
No, I have not run into anyone who doesn't love that book.
And it was, you know, and he's such an unassuming guy, and he never thought this was going to happen.
It could not have happened, truly, to a nicer human being.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And it was so, it's like someone trying to build a ship in a bottle, which I could never do, and he does it so perfectly that you can't, it doesn't make any difference whether you're a well-read person or not. You can't but feel at the end that all these skeins of yarn and all these threads are all of a sudden woven together, and you don't even know. You have to stop at the end and think, wait, all this stuff was about the same thing, you know?
Right. I've read it several times because I teach it, and so I really want to get to know it. And the more you read it, the more you see all those, how many skeins of yarn there are. Yes, we writers are a kind of jealous bunch, and we don't really love...
I know. I've heard this before.
Excuse me. I'm so sorry. We don't love each other's success, but with Anthony Doerr's success, it was just such a wonderful moment. I think every writer on Earth was just like, yes, a good guy won.
Yeah. And it's so funny because, not that there's anything wrong with it, but you can have Gone Girl and The Girl on a Train and... Mm-hmm. And then you can have that. And
yeah.
It's like, okay, wait a minute. I'm actually reading literature.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and people are reading it instead of reading Harry Potter or Divergent. Being adults and reading Divergent and talking about it as if they're reading a book. Well, they are reading. It's fine. But you know what I mean?
No, he tricks you into reading literature. It's
fabulous. Trick. It's a trick, and it's a great trick. It's wonderful. So we can move on to epigraphs now. That's two pages
okay.
in. Because we got the cover, the blurb,
the family tree.
So the epigraphs. The first one is one.
You want to do the dedication?
To your mom, because you love your mom.
I do love my mom.
Your parents.
Yes.
Yeah, you can tell, I mean, just what you say in that article, or no, your bio about your mom, just she sounds like a wonderful person.
She's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I can tell.
She called me up yesterday, and she's so excited because my book was reviewed in her Temple's Hadassah newsletter.
Did you used to get the Jewish Exponent when you were little?
Maybe. I don't remember. But, you know, it's been reviewed in all these other places. And this is, you know, and she said, and the last sentence said, and she's the daughter of our own Claire.
Oh.
So
what could be better?
She was out of her mind.
The only thing that could be better is if you were a doctor.
Exactly. Or my husband was.
Well, so going on to the epigraphs, the first one, which is interesting because it's Einstein, and Einstein's in the book, which we can talk about later,
mm-hmm.
but it's one that a lot of us know, and I kind of live by in a way, and the idea that time is a construct to avoid the human race having to have everything happen at once and kind of ruin our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But did you think of that one, which is the easy one, did you think of that one as you were writing, before you were writing? How did it come to you?
Well, I had not known it before. And as soon as I came upon it when I was doing research on Einstein, because he is a character in the book, I just knew that was what my book was about. To these women, to my narrators, their family is so present. Everything is so present to them. And they haven't quite figured out the construct that they can leave some things in the past. It's everything is in that apartment with them. And it just spoke to the idea of what the entire book was about.
Well, the second one, which is from Linda Hogan,
mm-hmm.
it's talks about we're the result of the love of thousands, which biologically is true, kind of like the misunderstanding about lips that like bruised pomegranates blush.
Right.
I mean, you're talking about two different types of lips. And here you're talking about love, which is how we're procreated and why we're here. But I never kind of completely understood what the love of thousands meant in terms of...
I think what she's referring to in the poem is that she says all my ancestors are behind me. So she's referring to everyone, the generations that form each of us, and we inherit the love of all those people. I included that because my narrators don't feel that. They feel they've inherited something quite different.
Right.
From their ancestors. But I wanted to signal even early on that while much of what happens in this book is sad and depressing and bleak and dark, I view the book as a life-affirming book. It's contradictory because the material is not itself life-affirming. But I feel that as readers engage with it, that they will not feel brought down by it, I hope, but actually able to see their own lives in contrast and appreciate their own lives, and also see what was good in the sisters' lives that the sisters could not see.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like, without spoiling anything, it's kind of like this convergence, kind of like Anthony Doerr. It's kind of like this convergence, deductive convergence from the very beginning into the end, where things that appeared one way appeared a different way now.
Yes. This notion that we don't really see ourselves and we don't really see our own lives. And my point of view, and I hope the book's point of view, is, so why not, you know, why not enjoy another day in the park?
I guess it's because, unfortunately, I have it. But a lot of us, or most of us, don't have any perspective. You can't, I'm constantly stepping back, observing who I am, what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, and I said this on the show too, it's kind of like a sadder but wiser thing, which I much prefer to ignorance is bliss, to having to having faith in a prime mover. Just think, if you were like a fundamentalist Christian, you would have such a great life because you have faith. You don't have to worry about anything. You know, it's like having your own personal masseuse.
Yes. Yes. And if you're certain kinds of people and Christians, I think you have forgiveness in a way that if you don't subscribe to that faith system, you have to figure out ways to forgive yourself and forgive others. You can't just, you know, apologize and go on. You carry it with you.
You know, it's funny, going along with the kind of metaphysical stuff, you talk about, in one of your, I don't know where it is, where do you talk about meaningful coincidences? It's in something you wrote. I mean, it was like an article or something.
Was it?
Yeah, it was about meaningful coincidences, which was so funny, because, you know, it's like Einstein's spooky action at a distance, and then you talk about Jungian stuff.
And, well, that's in the book, I think.
Yeah, I guess it is. You know, I was reading this morning, I was reading the commentary. So, yes, it is. And it was really funny because the guy I was interviewing yesterday, we were talking about Carl Jung and about that one day where he dreams of fish, and then he gets up and he sees a fish on the bank of the river, and then there's a fish, like, you know, six fish, okay, whatever. Or when he looks at the table and it kind of explodes. And so that's funny that we were talking about Jung, and then today I'm talking about Jung because of that.
Yeah.
That concept.
How often did that happen?
Yeah. Well, as long as I don't go out of here and see a fish, then everything's okay.
Or a scarab beetle in my book's case.
Oh yeah, you know, it's funny. They are, the three of them are kind of archetypical. They are archetypes in a way, I think.
The three.
Yeah,
sisters?
The three sisters. Yes. I just don't.
How so?
I don't know. I don't know which archetypes they are. I don't know if one of them's the trickster or not. You know, I don't know. I don't really know. But it seems like you said, oh, that's the other part of the book, is that I'm trying to figure out, you know, at the beginning I'm reading it, who's the narrator? Who's telling the story?
Right.
You know, and I know you did that, and I know it works really well, but I don't know when you decided that that's the way you were going to approach it, as if you don't know which sister is telling the story.
You know, I struggled with how to tell this story for many, many years. And one day it just occurred to me, oh, this should be written as a suicide note. That would allow me to get it to be from a technical perspective, it would let there be a lively voice if it were a note, if it were a letter people were writing. And when I thought about that, I thought, well, all right, who's writing the letter? Suddenly, I just thought, what if they are all writing the letter? Because that could happen. Obviously, if you picture it, one of them has a laptop. And I don't know how they're doing it, actually. But I thought that could be legit. Three people writing in one voice. People might not question that. So it was a very mechanical decision. But once I came up with that decision that not one of them, but all three of them were going to be telling this, the way siblings can almost speak as one, it made the book just came to me at that point. It just made the telling really easy. The voice came, the jokes came. So it wasn't calculated, and it was something I was nervous about. People don't love the first person plural. People will call it gimmicky.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it kind of worked in the context of a letter that all three were had a hand in composing.
I think it worked really well, and I don't necessarily have to think that they were gathered around like twins collaborating and knowing what the other one was going to say or something like that. Some, you know, they were gathered around fighting with each other about what words to put on the page. But I think it's equally effective if you just look at it as, hey, this is the way, I don't know, can't explain it.
Well, novels require a suspension of belief or disbelief when you enter it. Just the notion, who's telling any novel? You know, you pick up Dickens and it starts out, I am born. I mean, what? You know, who is telling this? Who's narrating the day of his birth? Well, it's David Copperfield and we just accept it. So there's, once you turn that cover and you start reading, you're sinking into an artificial world. So people tend, if it's not done clumsily, which you hope and pray your book is not done clumsily, I think people say, all right, let me go with this. Let me see where it takes me. And then before too long, you're not even thinking about it anymore.
Yeah, now that you've talked about it, I was just thinking back to Tristram Shandy, where it takes like 6 months before he becomes a homunculus in his mother's womb. And
yeah.
who the heck is telling that story?
Exactly. And those guys were kind of inventing the modern novel.
True. But I think he got paid by the word, too, so it might have been worth it. Well Dickens, too.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, we're back to lawyers now.
Sorry. I can't help it. It's an occupational hazard with me. what was I going to ask you? Did you ever hit anyone in the nose with a screwdriver?
No.
Came up.
I have not done too many of the things that are in this book.
Well, she didn't want to do it either.
No, she didn't. She just found herself doing it. But I have been thrown out of a hardware store by an obnoxious New York hardware store owner. So perhaps I have long wanted to hit a hardware store owner in the nose with a screwdriver.
Was there Was there a particular color of the implement you were attempting to purchase at the hardware store?
I wanted to buy chicken wire.
Ooh.
And they cut the chicken wire before showing it to me. This is burned into my head. And it was the wrong dimension. And I said, oh no, that's not what I wanted. And he said, get out.
Oh, well,
yeah.
Okay.
I was perhaps 19 at the time. I cried easily. I sort of walked the shame out of the hardware store and, yes.
Yeah.
I've held it in my heart since.
Well, there's a coincidence. I was using chicken wire yesterday.
Yesterday, and your life is just kind of, I think you will be seeing fish. I think that will happen.
You're probably right. Probably white.
Maybe having fish for dinner.
But it'll be gefilte fish.
Yes, gefilte fish. That's right.
That's funny because, look, I mean, that's where novels come from. I mean, that, like you said, it was burned into your brain. But what struck me about the whole few pages that took was the color. Almost like Ulysses has a color for a chapter.
Right.
And it was like, okay, is it sea green? Is it bluish? Sea green like the cover of Ulysses. but the screwdriver color seemed to hold some kind of poignancy for me, but I have no idea why.
I think for me, writing that scene, the reason I focused on the color was because she so didn't know what she was doing. You know, all she wanted to do was buy a simple screwdriver, and she just had no idea how to go about it. And it just sort of, to me, spoke to her helplessness and frustration and other failures in life. And so I had her choose the screwdriver based on the most unscrewdriverish characteristic, which was the color of the handle. So I really, you know, I wasn't thinking any more profoundly than a symbol of her helplessness. But this to me is, and when I teach, I talk about this all the time, that the writer will just put something down and a good reader will go to town with it. And it's this dance we do together. So I try not to overthink what's going on in the book. I try not to say, oh, I'm going to put a symbol here.
You did. And you said that the tip of the screwdriver was like a crucifix.
Yeah, I guess I did, but it is.
Well, you still did it. If you're the teacher and you're a certain type of professor, you're going to say, can anyone in the class explain why she felt it necessary to purchase the screwdriver based on the fact that a Christian symbol was at the end of it?
That's true. If I were that kind of teacher, I probably would say that. But I didn't even think about that. I was trying to describe what it looks like.
I'm psychoanalyzing you. Now you're thinking about it.
Yeah. I write. It takes me a long time to finish a book, but in the writing, I'm writing pretty quickly. So it is, in a way, you go back and people say, look at that, and look at that, and you're like, oh my goodness, wow. I'm both totally unconscious and incredibly profound. But I think, you know, Hemingway said this, if you're writing honestly and truly, all that stuff turns out to be there. I think you get in trouble if you think about it too much. Then it becomes clumsy and awkward.
Yeah, but Hemingway didn't have to think about it too much because he wrote so simply. I mean,
he did.
Which is, I mean, some people denigrate that now, but I still think it was amazing.
I wouldn't want to date Hemingway.
Oh, well, he had five.
He's a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
I think a lot of his personal life got mixed in with how people felt about his writing. I still love Hemingway. I think he's amazing.
That's funny because, this guy yesterday that I was interviewing, he wrote this book called Bee and Me, which is about Nicholson Baker and but in the creative criticism context, which I do not like this concept. I felt sound like, my name is Sam, and I always end up sounding like a Dr. Seuss book. But Bee and Me was based on Nicholson Baker's book, You and I, which is his book about John Updike and him. And this guy is like, it's like a Facebook entry where he goes, I'm eating lunch now, or here's a sunset I saw. And I always respond to my friends, well, yeah, I saw a sunset once too. You know?
Right.
And that's what this book is like. I'm saying to him, why am I interested in you talking about where you are and what you're doing as related to Nicholson Baker? And then eventually he just semi-hung up on me, but... which makes for a good radio.
I needed to think about it. I'll go off and think about that for a while and get back to you.
Well, so what about, the thing is when I read a book and I do these interviews, I'm thinking about you talking to me and I forget that there's people listening, so we need to sell your books. That's the idea.
Oh, all right.
And your book will be on the front table of where the bestsellers are.
Yay.
And if you can ever get up to outside Philadelphia and come by and do a signing, that would be great, like Christina Baker Klein just did. And also, I think we have a couple of book clubs that we run, and I'm sure this is a great book for a book club, I think. And I'm sure you've heard that before.
I love book clubs. I love talking to book clubs. I love talking. So I'm a professor. It's hard to shut me up. But, I would love to do that. I'm actually, this is not interesting for your listeners, but I may be east sometime in May and June. So maybe I can take a train trip to Philly.
Yeah, I'll talk to, I'll have my people get in touch with your people.
Oh, that would be nice.
I'll have Rebecca talk to Rachel again.
Okay.
So, what about, and this is where I was going, which has no interest to our listeners, what about the dentist and the relationship they had and the picture of the dog and things like that. Was that, did that form full blown from your head, like, you know, Athena? I mean,
just like Athena. Yes, the goddess of wisdom just pours from my head. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. That's not from life. That's not from my own life. That's not from anyone's life. The whole picture of the dog, I have no idea where the picture of the dog came from. So for your listeners, ladies having an affair with her boss who happens to be a dentist, which just struck me as the worst, you know, no offense to my beloved dentist friends, but ew. And she, in a moment of crazy jealousy, she snatches a picture of his beloved dog. She's not jealous of the dog. She's jealous of his new wife, and steals it. And I don't know why I wrote that, but I enjoyed that scene a lot. It just seemed like such a minor, but...
Well, she had every reason... she had every reason to do it. It was well done, because she just wanted to mess up this harmony that was created by this wife who really... Well, plus the idea that he calls his wife the wife, which I can't stand guys who actually do that at some golf club or while they're...
Yes.
I don't think it's done so much anymore.
I don't think so either. But that, I did know someone who used to refer to his wife that way. Well, the wife will be coming later. And that stayed with me, too.
Yeah, I have a friend who does that. But his wife never comes later. She may not even exist.
Well, that's true. I always wanted to say to these people, do you not know your wife's name? I'm sure if you asked her, she would tell you. So yeah, I mean, you understand completely why Lady does it. You know, his domestic life has encroached upon her little realm, and she's kind of kidnapping his beloved child dog. But you know, I see. That's the sort of thing I can explain now. But while I was writing, I was just narrating what happened.
That's cool. Yeah, that really is. And then, but, you know, you go, ooh, and you think of it, so that's there, too. And then you think dentists have one of the highest rates of suicide.
Yeah, I thought about that later, and I thought, all right, I'm just going to leave that.
Well, you know, plus he's in total denial, and they don't have a relationship, and she's trying to explain to him why they do.
Yeah.
Plus it's the worst week of her life because it's sweltering, and she doesn't want to be on vacation. She doesn't know what a vacation is. And,
right.
And she's in the toilet drinking vodka, although... Back in 1976, I don't think a martini was considered vodka. I think it was gin. But that's just me.
Ooh. All right, second edition revision.
Well, because I asked a bartender, a really old bartender, I said, does any kid ever come in and order a real martini with gin and vermouth? And he goes, no, I don't know. It's just all it is a glass of vodka. And
I think you're so right. And as a gin person, I should have known that.
Sorry.
That's all right. I'm just going to, if I do come into the bookstore, I hope you don't mind if I go to that page and just cross it out.
Well, we could just drink instead.
We could just drink and I won't care.
But Gibson's I like. I think you can get along with, you know, that's gin.
Yeah.
Except I can't drink gin. I have a horrible hangover. It's like Winston Smith in 1984.
I don't remember that aspect of 1984.
Well, they sold, Big Brother gave everyone a bottle of really, really cheap gin, and every morning he would wake up with these roomy red eyes, and after that I couldn't drink gin anymore. I got really sick.
That's so funny. You know, I was so young when I read that book, I don't think the drinking part registered.
Right. And that's, again, like yesterday. He was talking about Updike, and he was talking about this creative criticism crap, and it is, it's crap. But when I was little, I was like 12 years old, and I was reading I love John Updike, Rabbit Run and The Centaur and all that, mm-hmm. when I was a little kid. And I read the stories, and I didn't get the A&P story. So I wrote him a letter, and I said, you know, I don't quite understand what actually happened. Of course, I was 12 years old, so I couldn't, because it was all about sexuality.
Right.
And he wrote me back a postcard with a 3-cent postage stamp. And he wrote back, perhaps a simple rereading of the story would help you. And I really took that with me for the rest of my life.
Wow.
Which
That's
is
great.
Which is what you're doing with Anthony Doerr. You're reading it a lot.
Oh, yes, a simple rereading.
Yeah. Yeah.
Marilyn Robinson once said to me, "You can't say you read a book if you've only read it once."
Ooh.
So I took that with me.
Hmm. I guess that's why I've read Metamorphosis like maybe 300 or 400 times.
Yeah, well, according to Marilyn Robinson, I basically have never read a book. But someday I'm going to retire and I'm going to start all over again.
Yeah, sometimes it's a horrible wish, but I kind of wish I was sick in a hospital for like 6 months and all I could do would read. Or someone would lock me in my bookstore and there'd be a little slot where they'd pass food through.
Yeah, you don't want to be sick in a hospital because then you don't have the stamina to read. You have to work on that wish.
Well, I have two towers of the Oxford series, A Brief Introduction, too.
Uh-huh.
And if you just read both of those towers, you would know everything. Like that book by that guy who read the Encyclopedia Britannica for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the key, is the key to life in general, if you live a life that's sadder but wiser, is that all you're trying to do every day, and I think this is very true of authors, especially when you spend as much time as you did, is acquire as much information as you can.
Yeah. It interests me, people who aren't interested in doing that.
What about the fact that people don't look up? Especially today with their cell phones and all. They're always looking down.
Yeah, that's true. I just yesterday was thinking about that. Not that this is unusual, but every now and then I notice it on the elevator with my students. And I thought, well, we used to just look at the numbers passing by. It's not as if in the past scintillating conversation took place in elevators, but they are all looking down. There's a kind of moroseness to it.
Well, the worst is when you go out to dinner and you see a family of a husband and wife and two kids, and they're all on devices.
Yeah.
That's the very worst. I want to go over and just shake them all, but we're dinosaurs is what it's just going to get worse and worse.
It is. Sometimes, all right, so this is appropriately grim for the author of A Reunion of Ghosts, but I think, you know, if I had to live in an era and I have to die at a certain point, I don't mind checking out about now. I don't want to be cell phone person. I don't want to be, I'm not sure about this climate change stuff that apparently does not exist. You know, I'm not sure what the state of the planet's going to be. I'm not sure about politics. This might be a good time to check out.
Yeah, you wouldn't
have... I plan to do it any time this week.
Well, my mother and I have a relationship like the sisters. She's 92. She'll be 93. Mm-hmm. And she still drives every day.
Mm-hmm.
She has a depression mentality. So if she goes to the store and she looks at a jar of mustard, she'll say, "I wonder if I have one of these at home already."
Uh-huh.
So then she'll drive back to our house, and then if she does, she stays there. If she doesn't, she goes back. I said, "Mom, you're using up more gas." and then we went to this restaurant, this buffet that's horrible, where all these people are eating enormous amounts of food. And she wants me to take the senior discount, which I always refuse to do. And she made me take it, and everyone in the store in the restaurant was laughing. I said, "Mom, I'll just give you the 50 cents, okay?" And then, like, we'll talk, and I'll say, "Look, Mom, you're 93. You've lived a really good life. Why don't you just, you know, cash it in? You know, why don't you just, I've been waiting all this time for your money and all. Why don't you just call it quits?" I mean, or if I'm taking her picture by a lake, I'll say, "Could you step back a little further?"
My mother's 90 and also drives and also is amazing shape, but has that same depression mentality. And what I say to her is, you should spend it all. You should, on the last day, you should have zero left. But she's, "No, what about the kids? What about the kids?"
I know, my mother said, "I spent more today at the grocery store than I ever spent in my life." And I said, "How much did you spend?" She goes,
$44.05. Yeah.
It's like going to Starbucks.
Right, exactly.
Isn't it nice? Well, I don't know. Do you laugh with your mother?
Yes.
That's the most, and that's if she would be horrified if I gave her a eulogy, but if I do, the only thing I would say is that she made me laugh more than any person I ever met, and I made her laugh more than any other person she met.
Which, see, I can tie this back to my book, which if my book has any meaning, or, you know, the moral of the story is we should laugh a lot. That laughter is an incredible blessing and gift. And we should laugh about pushing our old mothers into the lake. And we should laugh about death. And we should laugh about sickness and sorrow. Because it's just such a great gift. And it's the one thing that gets us through. So that's the message of my book. Amidst all this suicide and fertilizer and chlorine gas and... oppression of women and animals, and
I think it's our mutually shared heritage. I don't know if this can affect everybody. I think it's just something about us.
But it's kind of a Jewish book.
Yeah, but I was hoping you would say that. I mean, I was hoping you would get to the point where you would say that was the message to take away. It's like my mom, me again. I think as long as you're laughing about death, like she just renewed her driver's license, and she goes, you know, what's the point? And she got a new car, and she goes, why would I get a new car? You know, I'm going to be dead before I even use it. And I think as long as you laugh at death, death gets really upset.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't want to come around anymore.
Yeah, you hurt its feelings.
Yes, yeah.
It's like, I'm the most serious thing there is, and yet, but you're a little funny, too. Well, and I have to say, I feel very lucky that so far, all right, here I'm going to curse myself, but so far all the reviews have gotten that. You know, they say it's a dark book, but they get that the humor is both helping you read it, you know, without it being overwhelming, but that also it's celebrating humor.
I think from knowing you for this past 46 minutes and 57 seconds, that I don't think you could write a book that didn't have laughter in it.
Well, I know. I keep trying. My first book I didn't think was funny at all, and people kept saying, oh, it's a farce, it's hysterical, and I was like, damn.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was thinking, and now I definitely have to read it now, because I didn't know who you were. You were not canonical.
I was not canonical.
And now you will be. And now this will be a movie, too.
You think?
And I can't.
I like the way you think.
Well, you'll be optioned if you haven't been already, you'll be optioned.
No, I haven't.
But then you got to think of who the three women are, and I have no idea.
I think Meryl Streep could play every character in the book.
That's what I was going to say. I'm so sick of Meryl Streep.
No, but she'd be good. She could do different, you know,
yeah, but
disguises.
She's so good, it's like she's almost telling you, look how good I am. Like even in Sophie's Choice, it's like I couldn't be better than this. But she's too old. She'd have to play Claire. You're Claire. I don't know.
Well, what about Meryl Streep for Aunt Violet? And we won't tell
Oh,
why.
Yeah, yeah.
And then her three daughters for the girls.
Yeah, but the three daughters have to be, at least in part of the book, 26, 19, and whatever. I don't
40.
Know. Yeah.
50. Yeah, I'm not sure how that's going to work. Maybe it could be a cartoon.
What, like they would run it on Saturday mornings?
No, it could be like a graphic novel kind of movie.
Yeah, it could easily be that.
It could be the first graphic novelish movie.
Yeah, I was just thinking of something horrible again, but...
Oh, dear.
No, it was like this ooze of green Cyclone B. It was horrible. Oh,
no.
God.
Yeah. We should say that, you know, this ancestor, oh, I think I said it, is based on this real person whose life intersected with the most horrible events of the 20th century over and over and over. It was mind-boggling to me. You could not make this stuff up.
Oh, start that from the beginning. That might sell books.
Okay. Well, his name was Fritz Haber. The first thing he did was he won the Nobel Prize for synthesizing fertilizer at a time when the world was on the brink of starvation. So I joke about it, but it was a hugely important development. It allowed people to eat. It staved off famine. But then he tweaked the formula and came up with chlorine gas, which was the first chemical weapon used in World War I, and he really fought for its use. His wife was a chemist also, and she knew what he was doing, and she couldn't get him to stop, and she wound up killing herself. We assume, no note was found, but we assume in protest of what he was doing. Years later, he was working on an insecticide when Hitler came into power, and he wound up leaving Germany, but the remnants of his team, the Aryan remnants of his team, took the insecticide, which was named Zyklon. They removed the odor that let human beings know they were in its presence. So the second iteration was called Zyklon B, which we know was the death agent used in the concentration camps. So while that wasn't intentional the way chlorine gas was, he nonetheless had a pretty significant hand in formulating Zyklon B, which is so chilling to me.
Unfortunately, this is normally, since we've gone 50 minutes, where I would end the interview, but I can't possibly end it on that note.
Okay.
You have to say something funny now.
I have to say something funny. Oh, that does not work.
Well, you can't end it on Zyklon B. It's impossible to end an interview like that.
Okay. did you hear the one about... No, I don't know.
Can you tell jokes at all?
I can't tell jokes. Can you? You say something funny.
Well, the only thing I was thinking is not even funny is like when the two Jewish guys are walking down the street and the one Jewish guy says... Chaim, I'm so sorry about the fire at your factory. And the guy goes, not yet.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, I am a reunion of ghosts.
Ladies and germs. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. This was so much fun. Okay, well, so if you ever get around, let's go drinking.
I am definitely going to make my way to your bookstore now.
Yeah, talk to some other people, and I think, you know, it's not like Ann Padgett's bookstore or Powell's or anything like that, but people like it, so I think you'd like it too.
Like it. and the drinking part.
Yes, definitely. Then there's a bar downstairs.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, wow. Let's do it.
A bookstore and a bar, that's heaven.
Okay, that's a good way to end it.
Okay.
All right, talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. So we were talking to Judith Clare Mitchell, who shares with me a heritage and a sense of humor. That was really fun, maybe my favorite ever. So that was a reunion of ghosts. It's a great book, has a great cover, and, you know, actually Anthony Doerr, who she, you know, she teaches them, and she's read the book over and over again, All the Light We Cannot See, which won the Pulitzer Prizes, and everyone in our bookstore who works there thinks it's the greatest book in the world, which I do too. So anyway, he thinks hers is a great book, and that's enough right there for me, but it really is a good book. And let's see, who do we got? Next week, or maybe the week after, we have Courtney Mom and then Lauren Acampora. And I know I talked about it last time, but I can't remember their books. But they will be read and by me, and we'll discuss them in the next couple of weeks. Lots of things going on at the bookstore. We have a sidewalk sale that's going to be reoccurring. Instead of sending books back that are wonderful that we haven't sold, we just knock off 40 or 70%, and it's the perfect time to come and buy them. Our open mic night is the second Friday of each month. Our children's story time is on Tuesdays at 10:30. We have a book club that meets, I forget which week, but it meets on a Wednesday in the day and Thursday at the night, so it can accommodate everyone. And lots of other stuff. Well, and all our social stuff. All these interviews are on YouTube, are on iTunes. And are on Twitter and our Facebook, and we drop them into this bucket called Dropbox. The authors get them. They put them on their web pages. So anyway, yeah, you can find us anywhere, assuming you can stand listening to me go on and on like I am now. And as always, I thank you so much for joining us here on The Avid Reader. Mm-hmm.